This is Nicholas Brendan, and you're listening to The Gaming Gang.
Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing The Walking Dead from Cryptozoic Entertainment. And hey, that's my fish from Mayfair Games. Jeff will be reviewing Adventures Under the Laughing Moon role-playing game. And Dystopian Wars from Spartan Games. We'll have news, views, and much more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
What's going on, my friend?
Oh, not much today for me. Well, I guess for everybody was Mother's Day, so spent a lot of time visiting some mothers.
Of course.
Not any in particular, you know, just random ones I found.
Yeah, not your own.
Of course
or
not.
Your wife's, no. Or you didn't even celebrate it with your wife.
No. Yes. Yes, we did. And it was quite lovely. Quite lovely.
Very nice. Very nice. I went and took my mom to go see The Avengers.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
All right. You got to tell me. What'd you think?
My mom digs the superhero movies, and she's seen all of them except for Captain America.
Okay.
Which, in my opinion, was one of the best ones recently.
Yeah, I liked Captain America a lot.
It's been on her blockbuster queue forever. So I would have to say, after all of the hype and all the big positive reviews, I found The Avengers to be one big steaming pile of awesome.
Really?
Yes, it was excellent. I will have a review of it sometime a little later on this week, spoiler free for people who have not seen it yet. But I will say, really probably one of the best superhero movies I've ever seen. I don't know. I can't say it's up there with The Dark Knight. I think The Dark Knight was the best.
Yes.
But pretty close. Pretty darn close. And it's about 2.5 hours long, so you really do get your money's worth.
Nice.
Yes.
I almost saw it tonight myself, but I didn't.
So there. There you have it.
What happens.
I do want to mention that things were a bit quiet this past week on the website for two reasons, really. Number one, as Elliot will attest, it was one of his weeks from hell that he has at work. So you were really tied up with a lot of work-related.
Yes, that is very true.
Responsibilities.
Yeah, lousy responsibility.
Damn them. And I was actually back in Chicago for a few days.
It's true.
Yes, and Elliot and I did get together this past Wednesday night, and we played some Twilight Struggle at a local pub.
We did.
We actually got in two games.
Uh-huh, and a good time was had by all.
Yes, we did have a great time. I don't know if Elliot wants me to mention this. Elliot was a little concerned about busting out Twilight Struggle in the middle of a bar, but you know what? People weren't giving us looks like, what are these guys, crazy? People were kind of looking over, going, you know, kind of thinking, what is this? And a woman actually came over to ask us about what we were playing. And we explained it in a pretty basic way. And she was like, wow, that sounds really cool. That looks really awesome.
Yeah.
So
true.
A little like gaming in public, I think. So that was pretty cool as well.
Yeah, it was quite enjoyable.
Anything else been cooking, my friend, since the last show?
No, not really.
No, me either. I don't really have any weird little side stories. I guess I can mention I went on a date last night.
Oh, how'd it go?
Well, let's just say there's a reason why I'm not a big fan of online dating sites.
Really? So you tried an online dating site?
You know, because I'm so busy all the time. And the people that I work with, I'm not saying anything negative about them. They're just not into the kind of things that I'm into, you know? So, and some of them are a lot younger. I don't want to look like I'm robbing the cradle. So I thought, try this free online dating site. And I've been emailing back and forth with a few people and ended up going out last night with one of them. Uh-huh. And just way too bizarre for me, man.
Really?
Yeah. You're selling crazy. I'm sorry. We're all fill up here. You never know. So, yes, I'm single. What can I tell you?
You pay your money, you take your chances.
That's right. I mean, it wasn't horrible. It wasn't, they turned out to be somebody whose picture was like 50 years old, you know, but they were just very, very bizarre. So anyway, so that's, no, I probably would have welcomed that.
I see.
Yes. She made Robin Williams seem like he's mild. Anyway, so there you have it. What do you say we move on to the news?
Sounds good.
Good evening, Mr. Missinoff from South America. All the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France, flash.
Well, Jeff, you know, it's funny you mentioned that you went on a date last night because I have a question. Who will be your mystery date? Yes.
I already found out.
I guess you did. Oh, well, there we go. Oh, no, wait, it's a news story. I got more. Yes, Mystery Date, the 1965 Classic Edition, is now available from Winning Moves Games. Relive those glory days playing this exciting game where you were never really sure if your dress would match your date and you would win the game. Mystery Date can be played with 2, 3, or 4 players. The object of the game is to be ready for a date by acquiring 3 matching color-coded cards to assemble an outfit. The outfit must then match the outfit of the date at the mystery door. Now, this is serious business here.
Yeah, I could tell. I mean, serious as a heart attack.
The date is revealed by spinning the door handle and opening the plastic door on the game board. The 5 possible dates are the formal dance date, the bowling date, the beach date, the skiing date, and the
serial killer.
The serial killer date. Look, Mommy, it's Jason.
Hey, he's come to pick me up in his panel truck.
The date to be avoided is the poorly dressed dud. He's wearing sloppy stained clothes. His hair is messy and his face is dirty.
Oh.
There was also a figure made out to represent a construction worker for another undesirable partner, as per prevailing values of the time.
Jeez. If I could think of worse people back in the 60s.
Right. Oh my God, a construction worker?
Exactly. Oh my goodness. Well, thank gosh, this one's an accountant. No offense to any accountants out there. I'm just saying.
If the player's outfit does not match the date behind the door is closed and play continues.
You're SOL.
And you can relive those glorious days of yesteryear for only $25.95. Winning Moves also has classic versions of other lesser-known games like Risk, Heyday, and The Game of Life.
All my all-time favorites.
I like Risk. Actually, the Risk 60-something, or maybe it was 59 edition, looked kind of neat, and the board is way smaller than it is now.
I actually have that. Are you talking about the one that comes in the wooden case? I got my hands on a special limited edition. Forget what anniversary it was, but it comes in a wooden box, and the board is a replica of the original board, and yes, you're right, it's much, much smaller.
Uh-huh.
It's actually kind of cool. Yeah, I don't hate Risk, but certainly wouldn't be the first game I'd reach for on the shelf.
No, probably not. But that's how I kind of got my kids, because I started playing Lord of the Rings Risk with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then, you know, got them a little more involved and stuff.
Sure.
Smooth them into things.
That slippery slope.
Now let's play War of the Ring.
Right. Ah! New from Victory Point Games is the first in the Death or Glory series. Designed by our pal Herman Luttman, In Magnificent Style is a solitaire game depicting the final desperate Confederate attack on July 3rd, 1863 at the Battle of Gettysburg, or what we more popularly refer to as Pickett's Charge. As General Longstreet, you must decide how quickly to press your troops across this deadly open ground before allowing the men to regroup for another bound. But time is not on your side, and the longer your stalwart soldiers remain in this maelstrom of enemy fire, the more dangerous it becomes, and the less likely they will arrive with the verve and numbers required to carry the day. With only 5 turns in which to reach your objective in attack, how far can you push your luck? Your options are simple: death or glory. In Magnificent Style is now available from our friends over at Victory Point Games.
All I have to say about this is, General Lee, I have no division.
Jeez. Up and to your posts! It's been a while since I saw Gettysburg. I'll have to watch it again one day.
Yeah, you remember going to see that?
Yes, I do. I remember we went and saw that. It was you and I, my fiance at the time. Was it just the 3 of us or was someone else with us?
Maybe.
It might have been Bob.
Was it?
Maybe. Yes, you know what? I think Bob did go with us.
Yeah,
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, great movie. Mm-hmm. And I say it all the time. You get to see Ted Turner get shot. What can you say?
Exactly. Worth the price of admission. You can now get Garbin Frozen during the Walt Disney World Star Wars Weekends. Yes, and I thought this was really cool. Guests attending Star Wars Weekends at Walt Disney World this year will have a chance to take part in that special moment in Empire Strikes Back when Han Solo was frozen in carbonite.
I have to interrupt you for a second. I read that on your post because you just posted that earlier today.
Right.
Why is that a special moment?
Because that is the moment when Princess Leia says, "I love you," and Han Solo says, "I know." Which is classic.
No. He says that before he's frozen.
Obviously, he doesn't say it after he's frozen.
Go ahead, continue.
The iconic moment is being duplicated as part of Disney Park's new Carbon Freeze Me experience, developed specifically for the annual Star Wars event at Disney's Hollywood Studios, beginning May 18th, 2012. Guests at Star Wars Weekends this year will be given the opportunity to step into a carbon freezing chamber.
And be frozen.
Oh! Located near the American Idol experience in the theme park, and have their faces 3D scanned using multiple cameras to create an 8-inch figurine depicting themselves frozen in carbonite. It also comes with a light-up wristband. Yay!
You don't only get this 8-inch figure of yourself frozen in carbonite, you get a wristband.
That's right. The figurine will be shipped to fans' houses after around 4 weeks, featuring the participant's face instead of the likeness of Harrison Ford, stuck in that famous pose. The resulting figurine will be able to be hung on a wall. It's part of Disney's D-Tech Me line of personalized products.
Hmm.
The cost will be $99.95 plus shipping and handling for the figure. You can purchase additional copies for $74.95. You need to schedule your appointment to be immortalized before you head out to Disney by calling 407-WDW-TECH. I got the number on the website, too, so you can see it there.
Interesting.
Star Wars Weekends at Disney Hollywood Studios will run from May 18th through June 10th, each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. There's a host of Jedi-inspired activities going on to keep you busy because theme park admission is required to get your carbonite figure.
You were talking about them taking all these pictures with various camera angles and that. I thought you were going to say that they were going to use 3D printers that they have to make your figure, but I guess that's not the case.
No, it takes 4 weeks, so
right.
I guess not.
Kind of cool.
Ah, that's cool, man. I wish I could do that.
I'm sure there are going to be plenty of people who are going to geek out on that. That's for sure. Stratus Games' latest project is Off Your Rocker, a party game of quirky insanity, and it's currently running on Kickstarter. You and the rest of the patients are suffering from a quirky problem, and the psychiatrist must guess what it is by asking random questions. Will he be able to diagnose the quirk, or will they end up just as crazy as you? Playing Off Your Rocker is pretty simple. Each round, one player is the psychiatrist and the rest are patients. The patients draw a quirk card and select one of the quirks. The psychiatrist then gets to ask the patient's questions. Whether they've asked the same or different questions, in every case, patients must answer in the most creative and entertaining way possible without directly revealing the quirk. Here's an example. The quirk is the player thinks they're trapped in a bottle. Question, what did you do today? Answer, I built a ship in a bottle and really got into it. Question, how do you feel? Not so great. I'm feeling a bit stuffed up right now. Question, what's your biggest fear? Answer, recycling. If the psychiatrist guesses the quirk before time runs out, he or she scores a point. Patients receive points for their performances as voted on by other players. The first player to 6 points will win. And as I mentioned, Off Your Rocker is currently running as a Kickstarter project.
You know what? Actually, that sounds kind of entertaining.
It could be.
It might be. Of course, it would require imagination.
Yes.
Kind of hard to come by sometimes.
Yes, I was going to say sometimes it can be a little difficult with a party game because you just never know how clever or quick-witted some of the people at the party are going to be.
Right. Dude, that's my skull. Right. I'm so wasted.
Yes. Question, how are you feeling? I'm trapped in a bottle. Okay.
Food Fight Snack Attack expansion is now available from Cryptozoic Entertainment. It's the Snack Attack expansion to Food Fight, which I believe I just said.
Yes, you did.
In Food Fight, the food world is in chaos, and the food mascots have declared war. No longer content to let consumers decide which food is best, they've assembled their armies and marched them to battle. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, three words that typically bring people together. Now battlefields are tearing the food world apart. Bacon versus eggs, burger versus french fries, mealtime condiments now forced to spoil one another and toss the leftovers down the garbage disposal. Who will win the food fight?
My God, the humanity!
The humanity! Food Fight is a fun card game for 2 to 6 players. Not content to let the main dishes hog all the glory, the soldiers of the Snack Brigade have joined the Food Fight. That's right, it's a snack attack. This add-on pack for Food Fight brings 40 new crispy, salty cards to the table, including 2 new Snack King mascots and 2 condiment instants to add some spice to your game.
Mm-hmm.
It's available now for $9.99 at game stores everywhere.
Speaking of Cryptozoic, they've announced a new expansion for the World of Warcraft trading card game, War of the Ancients. It's called Time Walkers. World at War! Even though monsters still lurk about, the conflict between the Horde and the Alliance, I did say Horde, takes center stage in the Time Walkers block, focusing on the humans, night elves, orcs, and Tauren. While the humans overwhelm their opponents with sheer numbers, and night elves stalk the shadows, the orcs' single-minded lust for war makes their allies grow stronger, and Tauren use their tribe power to share their unique skills with others of their ilk. Play with legendary heroes from World of Warcraft lore, such as Broxigar the Red, Malfurion Stormrage, and Queen Azshara. Do you know any of those names? Because I
Queen Azshara?
I don't know.
I took her out to dinner once. She wasn't very nice.
The new expansion for World of Warcraft trading card game should be in stores this October.
Available at online retailers is MIL-1049 from Homo Ludicus. In MIL-1049, your family struggles for prestige and influence in a medieval society. Will you succeed? You can harvest your lands for resources, recruit soldiers, and have descendants. Because it's very difficult to have ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just for the first generation. If you have a male heir, he can be married to another player's daughter. The one with the biggest dowry, of course.
Obviously.
A strategical key point, though, keep in mind that during the game, your knights will die or retire, and their sons will have to take their place. Knowing the ins and outs of the court will help you gain influence and vassals. While in the market, you will be able to trade resources and recruit the necessary workforce to build a castle. How about going to battle to get some new lands or helping the curia to build a cathedral? The abbess of the monastery can bless you with the influence of alcohol. The
nice.
Abbess.
Yay!
The
they did drink a lot of that back then because they sure didn't drink the water.
That's right. Well, you know, I've seen Friar Tuck. He's always drunk in all the movies. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, with a big mutton chop in his hand.
Right. While the echoes of the Crusades resound in a faraway land with songs of glory and honor, there isn't one single way that leads to victory. So which one will you choose?
The one that involves the alcohol?
And victory. MIL is for 2 to 5 players ages 12 and up and takes about 90 minutes to play. Note that in today's Roman numeral notation, 1049 is actually written as MXLIX, but MIL just seems to flow off the tongue so much better.
They could have just called it 1049.
They could have, but then it wouldn't have been Roman.
That actually flows off my tongue a lot easier than MIL-1049.
Maybe people would have thought that would have been the price. Because it's actually about $70.
Right. I have to ask, is this a board game, a card game? Is it a combination of both? Have you seen what it looks like at all?
I saw a picture of it. I don't remember at all. No, actually, it's a board game.
Okay. I was going to say, for $70, it's got to be a board game.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Huh. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Have to check that out from company.
Homo Ludicus.
Homo
I
Ludicus.
Believe it came out at Essen, and it's just kind of making its way over here bit by bit.
Okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Numbskull Games is now accepting pre-orders for Divided Republic. On the eve of the American Civil War, the country's fate lies in doubt as its leaders make their arguments and its people make their decision. Slavery, states' rights, and the shadow of war are at stake as you seek to have your candidate win the presidency and save the nation. Divided Republic is a card-driven 2-to-4-player game representing the last calm before the storm that was to become the American Civil War. Players represent the 4 major parties: Constitutional Unionists, Northern Democrats, Republicans, and Southern Democrats. And they attempt to win the presidency by defeating their opponents using dirty tricks, platform speeches, and the manipulation of key historical events. All the while, President Buchanan interferes, radicals riot, and the country continues the downward spiral towards civil war. Buchanan interferes? I thought he just basically sleptwalked through his whole presidency.
That's what I always heard.
Yeah.
I went and voted for the write-in Whig candidate anyway.
Yeah, well, you're old school like that.
Right.
If one party wins the election, history may very well change. Nevertheless, there is always the chance that the population of South Carolina will finally explode into open rebellion and secede, ending the game, at which point everyone loses. As I did mention, Numbskull Games is taking pre-orders right now for Divided Republic.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Like a Lincoln versus Douglas thing, huh?
Yeah. I think Fremont, it's the 4 major parties.
Yeah, but who knows the other two?
I just said Fremont.
Okay. Who besides you knows at least one of the other two?
Probably a lot of people.
All right, fine.
Not us. I can't name the 4.
I believe his name was Johnson.
Yeah, it may very well may have been.
I think I'm pretty safe with that guess.
Lyndon B. Wait a second, huh? What?
The Doom That Came to Atlantic City is now on Kickstarter.
Yay! See the USA in your Chevrolet.
Once people came to Atlantic City to seek their fortune.
City, but...
No, but, you know, it's good. Although, was that even a commercial? It had to be before we were born.
Oh, gosh, yes. Honestly, I think it may have originated on the radio.
I think you're right.
Could be.
Once people came to Atlantic City to seek their fortune, to construct fine hotels and establish powerful monopolies. But
that's the first thing that popped into my head when he talked about hotels.
Mm-hmm. But you're not here to build. You've come to destroy.
I've seen this Kickstarter project, yes.
Yes. You're one of the great old ones, beings of ancient and eldritch power. Cosmic forces have held you at bay for untold eons, but at last the stars are right and your maniacal cult has called you to this benighted place. Once you regain your full powers, you will unleash your doom upon the world.
That's my game plan.
Mm-hmm. There's only one problem, though. You're not alone. The other great old ones are here as well.
Ah, for crying out loud.
Just when I get out after millions of years! And your rivals are determined to steal your cultists and snatch victory from your flabby claws. It's a race to the ultimate finish as you crush houses, smash holes in reality, and fight to call down the doom that came to Atlantic City. The Doom is the brainchild of artist Lee Moyer, inspired by his love of the Cthulhu mythos and disdain for a certain board game that shall not be named. But actually, it's Monopoly.
Yeah, you're right. They already said it.
Right. Game designer Keith Baker is best known for the Origins Award. Keith Baker, wasn't he? Oh, no, that's Kenny Baker.
Yes. R2-D2?
Yes.
We joked about that one other time.
Is best known for the Origins Award winning card game Gloom. And he brings the same dark sense of humor to the devastation of Atlantic City. Keith and Lee enlisted the help of their friend Paul Komoda to design some of the more eldritch visual elements of the game. Paul's talents can be seen on screen in the prequel to John Carpenter's The Thing and Cabin in the Woods. He brings that vision and long association with H.R. Giger to his designs of the Great Old Ones. The game bears a distinct resemblance to Monopoly, but instead of playing a puny mortal building a city or closing gates to save the world, you play one of the Great Old Ones, seeking to tear down the city, open the gates, and destroy the world.
Whee!
The game will come with 8 highly detailed plastic figures of the Great Old Ones so that you can be your favorite. The Doom That Came to Atlantic City is on Kickstarter right now until June 6th. With a pledge of only $75, you can get a copy of the game with the figures in pewter.
Weird. I see. I don't know. Anytime I see a game that the board is, in effect, a Monopoly board, I kind of back off.
Yeah, I don't know. I have to go watch the video. I haven't watched the video. We'll see what the video does for me. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes, I haven't watched the video either. I did see the announcement and I did check out the Kickstarter project. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can never, ever have enough Cthulhu. Can you, Elliot?
No.
Can you really ever have enough H.P. Lovecraft?
No, you can't.
That's why Eldritch Skies, the horror RPG, is now available!
Woot!
The year is 2030. The Gilman Hawking Drive has given us access to the stars. But we are not alone. They're out there. Aliens, gods, and monsters.
Oh my.
They're also down here. The Miskatonic Antarctic Expedition found the Elder One City in 1931. The Mego crashed in Roswell in 1947. Hey, that clears up that whole mystery now. Now we know what it was.
Right.
In 1958, as quietly as possible, not knowing what we were doing, we bent occult powers to our hands and took the step to Mars. The third time, the men who made that step could not step back. We fled back into our cave for a while. But rocketry and the Soviets brought us back out soon enough. Competition took us to the moon. Uneasy teamwork saved the astronauts who would have died there among cyclopean immemorial ruins. In 1994, human scientists cracked alien technology and overcame the light speed barrier. They brought us the stars. They also brought us the madness that lies between them.
And microwave popcorn.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm getting to. And the mind-twisting undarkness of hyperspace. Not really sure what undarkness would be.
Undarkness, wouldn't that be light?
Yes, that's what I was thinking. The future is here. Machine-made telepathy, augmentations, and unprecedented levels of automation have changed the face of Earth. But the science of sorcery and our primitive understandings of what lies outside have changed more than our minuscule planet. They've begun to let humanity out. We walk amongst giants. Tread carefully. Eldritch Skies is a complete role-playing game of Lovecraftian science fiction that uses the cinematic unisystem, also used in Ghosts of Albion and Buffy. It contains all the rules you'll need to play and requires no additional material beyond your imagination and a few dice. Eldritch Skies is now available in PDF at RPG Now and DriveThruRPG.
Sweet. It always reminds me of that Peter Gabriel song where he sings about the Lovecraftian horrors. How does that one go? Me go.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. There you go. Okay.
Fantasy Flight Games is to republish Netrunner. Yes, Fantasy Flight Games has announced the upcoming release of Android Netrunner. Originally designed by Richard Garfield and released in 1996, Netrunner was widely hailed as one of the greatest customizable card games of its era.
Mm.
Now, was it? I don't
Continue.
Remember.
No, not really.
Now with Android Netrunner, players can look forward to revisiting the game's exciting play, or experiencing it for the first time, which would be me, actually. Android Netrunner is an asymmetrical living card game for two players, set in the cyberpunk future of Android. The game pits a megacorporation and its massive resources against the subversive talents of lone runners. Corporation players try to score points by advancing their agendas, and Netrunners try to score points by breaking through the corporation's defenses and stealing valuable data. The first player to 7 points wins the game, but not likely before he suffers some brain damage or bad publicity.
Or both.
Well, hopefully the player doesn't actually suffer the brain damage.
No. Or the bad publicity
right, that would be bad.
That's brought on by brain damage. I hate when those stories come out about
right.
me. I really do.
Brain damage!
And it's a spinning newspaper. You know, brain damage!
In a world where corporations can scan the human mind and interface it directly with electronic data, more data moves every second than was ever processed in the first 5,000 years of written language. The network is omnipresent, the crux of modern human civilization. And while visionary corporations seek to secure their most valuable data on the network, the elite hackers known as Netrunners seek to steal it. This asymmetrical card game resurrects the mechanics of the original Netrunner and updates them to increase clarity and promote a more dynamic play environment. The Android Netrunner core set features 252 cards, including 7 unique identity cards. Netrunner is scheduled to be released in the third quarter of this year. That's 2012 for those of you listening at home.
Right, who don't know what year it is. I do recall Netrunner when it first came out. For some strange reason, I want to say I did actually play it. I don't remember if I liked it or not, but I believe it was a commercial flop. If I remember correctly, it did not sell well at all.
I have no clue. I don't even remember the 90s, man.
I know. And they say alcohol kills brain cells. Ha!
There's so many other things that can kill brain cells, as I found out.
Of course. Such as brain damage.
Exactly. Oh, great. Now that's going to be on the news tomorrow.
Flash! Escora Games will soon release Nefarious, the mad scientist game, to stores near you.
Near me?
Yes, you. You're a brilliant scientist, and okay, you may be a little mad. But who isn't a little bit frustrated these days? At least you're channeling your anger in a positive direction, inventing incredible devices to advance your goal of taking over the world. Plutonium, secret layers, and minion insurance are expensive, though, so you'll have to research, work, and even speculate on what your enemies will do in order to raise the funds to fulfill your dastardly plans. Nefarious, the mad scientist game, is a quick-playing game for 2 to 6 players, where the players race to build inventions like a freeze ray, cloaking device, or robotic pet before their opponents can. Your strategies to get the money to build your creations will have to vary, though, as each time you play, Nefarious will have a different environment thanks to its fiendishly clever twists.
Fiendish.
Nefarious, yes, fiendishly clever. Nefarious, the mad scientist game, should be coming to stores soon.
Now, that makes me think of Dr. Horrible right off the bat.
I thought this would be something that might interest you.
Oh, yeah. With my freeze ray, I will stop the world. I highly recommend Dr. Horrible's Sing Along if anyone hasn't seen it.
Yes.
Starring Neil Patrick Harris and Felicia Day.
Well, we already know that you're a huge Glee fan, so obviously any musical out there... You a big fan of Rent by any chance?
I haven't seen Rent, I'm sorry to say.
I'm teasing. I love Singing in the Rain, so I'm just teasing you.
I'm singing in the rain.
Yes, it's the all singing, all dancing edition.
I'm
going to
sing all my stories from now on.
Are you? Yeah, well, I guess.
You're not going to ask me if I'm drunk again, are you? Or high?
No,
it
no,
seems
no.
like every episode you ask me, are you drunk or high or stoned?
No. I was going to say, is this how you're celebrating our 41st episode?
41, woo!
I decided we've got 40 shows under our belt, so now I can branch out and show my dramatic and musical talent. I'm juggling right now.
You should see my plate spinning. Divinare is being released this month by Asmodee. In late 19th century London, England, prominent mediums gathered for an historical tournament whose winner will be named the best clairvoyant of the century. Players will incarnate the finalists of this tournament. Whatever that means.
It means you represent one of the finalists.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
I guess, yeah. I don't know if I
incarcerate the finalists.
That way. Yes, right.
Their goal is to guess the cards in the hand of their adversaries to eliminate how many cards of each category will be shown at the end of the game. But will bluffing, tactical playing, and their divinatory powers make better predictions than their competitors? Stay tuned, fans. Players play the part of famous mediums who must attempt to divine the cards held by their opponents. See? So in each round, only 2/3 of the cards, representing the 4 divination methods of... All right, stay with me here. This is a difficult sentence. Of chiromancy, crystallomancy, tassiolomancy, and astromancy are dealt out, and then are revealed little by little, giving the players the possibility of narrowing their predictions.
You know, I dated Astro Nancy's sister. Her name's Barbara.
Barbara Matt. Oh, damn. For some reason, I keep bursting into song. I'm sorry.
Yes, I don't. What are you, drunk or high?
A good prediction will allow the players to win points, but guess wrong and you may be forced to take a penalty. Mm-hmm. They put you in a box over on the side.
Stand in the corner now.
The player with the most points after a set number of rounds wins. There is a contest to go along with the release of the game, and the contest runs through May 31st and involves answering 4 questions and emailing the answers to Asmodee. Four winners will be selected and will each receive a copy of Divinare. You can find out all of the details, the questions, and where to send your entry on the Asmodee website at us.asmodee.com. You know, after reading that, I still have no idea what this game is about.
Honestly, it just sounds boring.
I don't know. There's predictions involved.
You're guessing what cards are in somebody else's hands. That's what's coming across to me. That's like a billion other games out there. I don't know. But maybe I just wasn't hearing it right. Maybe it's the best thing since sliced bread. I don't know.
Come on. There's been nothing good since sliced bread.
I know. Exactly. Even unsliced bread. What a disappointment that's always been.
Exactly. Alderac Entertainment Group has released the Strongholds of the Empire sourcebook for the L5R role-playing game, and it's available as a PDF purchase at DriveThruRPG. The book can be downloaded as a PDF or ordered as a color or black and white print on-demand book. Let me make it clear that the sourcebook is available only at DriveThruRPG as an exclusive item.
Only!
Only there. Across the Emerald Empire, the greatest servants of the Emperor make their homes in ancient castles, elaborate courts, impregnable fortresses, venerable dojos, and majestic palaces. Some exist in the wilds of the Empire, while others mark the center of a great, sprawling city. Some are centers of trade and artistry, while others exist far from any other sign of civilization. And yet, despite their many differences, it is in the heart of each of these bold strongholds that the heart of the samurai dwells. Strongholds of the Empire explores a handful of the many unique cities throughout Rokugan, seeking out those with particular interests for the different great clans. In addition to new mechanics for each of the clans, as well as for each individual city, this book contains information on the following. The Crab's Economic Powerhouse, Clearwater Village. The extensive holdings of the Crane and Lion clans in the Imperial City, Toshi Ranbo. The tradition of the Dragon Clan Smiths in Waterhammer City. The Mainland Mantis Port of Broken Wave City. The diplomatic endeavors of the Phoenix Centered in Nakasaki. The illicit interest in the Scorpion at Zakyo Toshi.
Ooh, boo, scorpions, boo. Ooh, they're like the scumbags of L5R.
They're like the Slytherin.
Kinda.
The Spider Clan's sinister secrets in the ruined city of Atusan Uchi.
Ooh, they're even worse than the scorpions. Ooh,
yeah, I hate spiders.
Clan. Ooh, yeah, I know you do.
The dueling traditions of the unicorn at Dark Edge Village, and more. And it's available right now at DriveThruRPG for different prices. $19.99 for the PDF.
Interesting that AEG is going with a print-on-demand for the supplement.
Yes, that's what I thought as well.
Here's something that I'm kind of curious about. Mm-hmm. Have you ever noticed that DriveThruRPG and RPG Now are effectively the same website?
I have noticed that, yes.
So that's why I'm kind of curious. It's exclusive only to DriveThruRPG.
But maybe there's some secret society going on there that I'm just not aware of.
I actually think I know the reasoning, but I'm not going to get into it.
All right, then. That's fine. So what are we talking about now?
We're not going to talk about anything. We're going to sing. So that's it as far as the news. I know normally at the end of our news segment, we usually talk about something related to the website or the podcast. I don't know. Don't really have anything to share this time.
Go visit the website and listen to the podcast.
Aren't they already doing that?
I guess they would be.
Well, they're listening to the podcast. They may not necessarily be at the website.
Yes.
But we will be at Origins, so we're looking forward to that. Our next show falls onto Phoenix Comic Con.
Oh.
So I do believe I have to say that our podcast might be a little late next time, folks, by a day or two. I can't say for sure, but it's very, very likely. So you've been forewarned. There's the news for this time around. What do you say we move on to the reviews?
All right, let's go.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
My first review is Hey, That's My Fish, the deluxe second edition from Mayfair Games, which has also been published by Fantasy Flight Games and others. Lots of others.
Isn't it available right now from Fantasy Flight?
Yes, it is available right now from Fantasy Flight Games.
And Mayfair.
It was designed by Gunther Comet and another guy, Alvidus Jacolinius, something like that. Sorry, I apologize.
Right. As people can tell, you have a hard enough time with English.
Right.
So do I. I'm not knocking you. So
it came out in 2003 for 2 to 4 players, ages 8 and up. Takes about 20 minutes to play, since it has been a while since I've reviewed a children's game.
You're going to talk like a child while you...
I'm going to talk like a child. Hey, That's My Fish is a classic, so I thought it was high time that I told everybody else about it who doesn't know.
Okay.
The game's been around for almost 10 years, and it's been published by an array of companies. The current version is the one published by Fantasy Flight Games, but I didn't get the FFG version. Instead, I chose the Mayfair Games Deluxe Edition, and there's two reasons for this.
It has real stuffed penguins?
Yes, life-size. That's why it's deluxe.
They're emperor penguins?
They all have happy feet.
Jeez.
There are two reasons for this. The principal one being that the Mayfair version comes with 16 high-quality three-toned penguins in the 4 different player colors. So they have backs and flippers in the player color. They have orange beaks and feet and white bellies. The FFG version has the penguins in one solid player color. So they aren't as cool-looking. The FFG version does use new sculpts that look kind of cool, but I still prefer the Mayfair penguins. The second reason is that the Mayfair version is still available, and I wanted the deluxe edition. Let me point out, however, that the Fantasy Flight Games version is only $12.95 and comes in a much smaller box. The Mayfair deluxe edition is $30 at the Mayfair website, and that's actually on sale. The one thing I couldn't figure out, though, and I looked around for it, is I know the Mayfair penguins are about 2 to 3 inches tall.
Okay.
I don't know how tall the FFG ones are.
Foot and a half.
Foot and a half, right.
Oh, sorry. It's not deluxe. No, probably about the same size.
Yeah. Each of the cute little penguins is in its own slot inside the box. The only other components are 60 thick tiles that make up the game board. To begin, each player selects a penguin color and gets the 4 penguins of that color. Then you have to arrange all 60 hexagon tiles in an approximate square shape. This is the only part of the game that's a pain, as you have to remake the board every time you play, and it does take a couple of minutes. You don't have to do a square shape. You can really do whatever you want, but they suggest starting with a square and adapting after you know how the game works. One hint is to make sure that you leave a little space between each tile so that both little and big fingers can pick up a tile without messing up the whole layout. The tiles look like little ice floes, and each has from 1 to 3 fish pictured on them. After the layout is set up, the players take turns setting up their penguins on a tile, one by one, until all the penguins are placed on different tiles. They can only be placed on a tile that shows one fish in the initial setup. And you're ready to play. Players take turns jumping a penguin from one tile to another tile. They can only move in a straight line, but in any direction, kind of like a queen in chess does. You want to place your penguin on a tile that has the most fish pictured on it, as these will end up getting added to your score pile.
Yummy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, fish. The object of the game is to have the most fish in your score pile when the game ends in order to win. The tile that you move your penguin from is picked up and added to your score pile. So as you play the game, the tiles will slowly disappear. You can only move one of your penguins per turn, and if they get trapped on a tile with no place to go, they get removed from the board, along with the tile that they're standing on.
Damn you, global warming!
You blew it up! I don't know why I keep going back to the Planet of the Apes.
I don't know. You did it last show, too.
I saw it recently. In this way, you can end up with tiles that no one can get to, and if this happens, then these tiles are removed, but they don't get added to anyone's score pile. Once all the penguins are gone, the game is over. Count up all the fish on all of the tiles in your score pile, and the player with the highest amount of fish wins the game. The suggested ages are 8 and up, but it's simple enough for children as young as 5 to play the game. It might take a while for them to learn the strategies for getting the highest score, but that's one of the great things about the game. It can teach kids how to plan ahead and makes them think while still being fun. You can also teach them how to count up all of the fish for themselves, which is great practice for the little ones. The game is entertaining enough for the adults to have a good time, too. Hey, That's My Fish is a lot of fun and a great teaching game for the little kids. My daughter also loves just playing with the penguins.
Mm-hmm. And I knew that was coming.
Of course. And this is fine, as they're fairly indestructible unless you are also letting them play with power tools at the same time, which I try never to combine the two.
Right, one or the other, not both.
Not both. So there you have it. Hey, That's My Fish. We're really into that right now.
don't some adults play that game too?
Sure. I mean, it can be entertaining as a very light gateway game for just showing people how other games work that are not Monopoly based.
And as a quick game too. It doesn't play all night long. It's what, about 20 minutes or so?
Yeah, at the most, it's fast.
Hey, That's My Fish is a classic, no doubt.
Yes.
I've never had an opportunity to play it. Probably more because it is geared towards kids and I don't have any, so.
Right, exactly.
And I don't usually hang around with people who do have kids. Not that I have anything against them, don't get me wrong, I like kids. But a lot of times their kids aren't little kids if they even have kids. So very cool. And the deluxe edition is still available from Mayfair.
Yes, it is.
Nice.
And it is on sale for $30.
Yeah, that's kind of a toss up there. When something is designed as a children's game, sometimes I have a hard time justifying to myself a high price for that kid's game.
That's very true.
To me, $30 is a little much for a children's game.
Yeah, you could probably find it somewhere else cheaper, like one of the online retailers.
Oh, sure. I'm thinking. Right.
But I did like this edition. The Fantasy Flight edition may be the greatest thing in the world, but I don't know. I didn't play it. I wanted the multicolored penguins.
And the deluxe edition is still available. So you are reviewing something that's out there that people can pick up.
Yep.
Yeah, let's review stuff that's out of print. Boy, I wish you had this now.
Don't you wish you had this game?
We do. My first review is Adventures Under the Laughing Moon. It's a role-playing game written by Todd Van Hooser. He's an author that's local to the Phoenix area, and it's based on his Laughing Moon Chronicles series of books. Although, truth be told, I believe only one of the books has made it into print so far, and it's called The Baron 12. The game was released in 2010. The RPG introduces players to the world of Mithrin, where magic and danger are part of everyday life. Prophecies warn of magical persecution and the rise of ancient powers. Shadows of evil threaten the lands as a call for heroes is sounded. The era in the history of Mithrin, in which the game takes place, is the Age of Prophecy, where magic is forbidden and a multitude of gods look to increase their presence and, of course, power in the world. Let's begin by talking about what's good about the book. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's very nicely presented, nice quality stock, plenty of well-done artwork, and there's quite a bit of photography throughout. Everything is laid out in an orderly and fairly logical fashion as well, and the writing is pretty good. And unfortunately, that's pretty much going to be the end of the kudos. Yes. As Elliot will certainly attest, I've no doubt owned and read through at least 100 RPGs in my day, minimum.
Oh, yes.
In that time, I've seen some great ones, a multitude of average or mediocre ones, and a few that were steaming piles of crap, not steaming piles of awesome like the Avengers. I have to say that Adventures Under the Laughing Moon falls squarely into the middle category. And there's quite a few problems that I actually have. First of all, as I mentioned, there's loads of artwork and photography throughout. But the problem is, there's just too much of it. In my review of Marvel Heroic Role-Playing a while back, I talked about that fine edge a core rulebook walks along regarding an art-to-text ratio. As I pointed out, Marvel Heroic Role-Playing from Margaret Weiss Productions came pretty damn close to crossing over that line. But in the end, I didn't think it did and felt the buyer was getting enough content and bang for the buck that there wasn't any sort of an issue. Here, on the other hand, Adventures Under the Laughing Moon comes across as kind of a jip, as not only is there too much artwork, but the text font that's used is way too large, which obviously artificially inflates the page count. Reading through the core book made me think of sitting down in a restaurant and ordering a steak, and when it comes, I'm looking at 2 ounces of steak buried under a pile of parsley. Sure, the garnish is nice, but that's not what I sat down to eat. I'd take a guess that if you were to take the graphics out and produce the text in a standard size font, you'd be looking at about 70 pages or so, tops, instead of the 174 that make up the book. And that includes the various charts in my 70 pages or so. Hmm. As a comparison, I busted out some other RPGs from my collection, old and new, to take a look. And nothing I paged through came anywhere near the ratio of graphic to text.
even those that have a lot of art, like, say, the aforementioned Marvel heroic role-playing or Legend of the Five Rings, still provided enough there. L5R is especially crammed full of info in spite of the fact that nearly every page has some excellent artwork. To paraphrase the old Wendy's tag, I wonder, where's the beef? Next is the actual mechanics of the system. Actions are based on a 20-sided die with various different dice used for damage and such. Characters have various attributes, skills, and so forth that you need to roll less than on a 20-sided die to succeed. Adventures Under the Laughing Moon uses what's also known as the exploding die mechanic, although it's not called that here, regarding damage dealt, spell effects, whatnot. Whereas if you roll the highest number on that particular die, you'll get to reroll and add the new result to your original roll. There's no indication if you get to reroll again if you hit the max on your second roll, though. We have the basic fantasy character attributes, skills, and so on, so there's nothing new here. And Adventures Under the Laughing Moon uses a feat system, which is known as Bandu here, that represents luck, good karma, whatever, that's given to each player at the beginning of each session that they can use to make rerolls and add bonuses to the results. All the usual suspects are here as well, as far as fantasy races and character classes too. Around 70 pages or so are devoted to what I would consider the character creation process. The rest of the book is extremely light when it comes to other aspects and actual gameplay. The magic section is very sparse, surprising in a game with a fantasy setting, with each level having 3 sample spells included for your perusal. I understand a magic supplement was just released, but for an initial core book to only have 21 spells and a handful of magic items, that's kind of a cheat. Mm-hmm. The monster section is about the same, with 30 monsters, with most receiving about a paragraph of description as well as the stats. The section devoted to gameplay is all of 20 pages, covering money, leveling up, critical hits, and so on. And much of those 20 pages are simply charts. The last thing I'll touch upon that I really didn't care for is the setting itself. As in, there isn't a whole lot of info about it. The history of the game world is 3 pages in length, with a few pages of adventure nuggets to mine later on in the book, as well as a few items of interest sprinkled throughout. That's about the extent of it. I know more detail about the setting in the game world of my next review, and that's a miniatures game, not an RPG. All in all, the feel I get from Adventures Under the Laughing Moon is that of a group of friends who like role-playing games, although maybe they haven't played a whole lot of different ones, getting together and deciding to write their own RPG. The rules are heavy on the character creation side, while providing very little in the way of a magic system, character advancement, monsters, or any meat and potatoes of actually gaming the system. In the end, I feel I'm looking more at the beta edition of an RPG as opposed to a finished product. At the end of the day, when I review any sort of a role-playing game, much of my final verdict isn't based on mechanics or artwork, but story and setting. Is this a game or adventure I feel like I want to play? Is there something interesting or compelling that, even though I might not want to run it, would make me look forward to sitting down at the table with that product and participating in it? I have to say, nothing with the core book for Adventures Under the Laughing Moon jumps out at me to demand my attention. One other thing to note. To my knowledge, we're the first site or podcast to actually do a review of Adventures Under the Laughing Moon. Maybe there's some out there, I don't know, but I think we're the first. But there are 6 buyer reviews on RPG Now and Drive-Thru RPG, because as I mentioned before, they're pretty much the same site, and they each give the game 5 stars out of 5. To me, this is my gut reaction, and you can take it simply as this, a gut reaction. But something seems a little fishy to me when the game makes its appearance on Drive-Thru RPG and RPG Now on March 14th of this year, and the reviews show up between March 25th and the 30th. All 5 stars, and all, if you read through them, really don't tell you anything about the game itself. They almost seem like they're written by some high school students or something like that. It almost makes me think that people were given promo coupons, because to review a product, you have to be a buyer of of that product. And I kind of have to say my gut reaction as far as those reviews on RPG Now and DriveThruRPG, the fix was in.
Dun, dun.
This is just a gut reaction that I have because this is not a 5-star product by any stretch of the imagination. It's maybe 2.5 stars. If you take the art and photography out, you're probably going down to 2, maybe even less than that. I do want to point that out. On a closing note, I do want to mention something as well. I don't like giving bad reviews. I really don't. I don't get a kick out of it. Elliot doesn't get a kick out of it either. And I really dislike giving a bad review when it's someone I've sat down with and done an interview with, as I did with Todd Van Hooser at the Vulcan convention. And they're a very nice person. They're an interesting interview. And you really look forward for them to succeed. I will also point out that Todd is very, very involved with Adventures Under the Laughing Moon here in the Valley. He's at all the different conventions. He's always running games. He goes out to game days and he runs the system. Let's be honest here. If you had the opportunity to sit down with the person who's the designer of the game, you're probably going to have a pretty darn good time. Unfortunately, that does not translate to people who purchase the book. So now I'm sure a lot of the locals are going to be burning me an effigy, as they sometimes do.
I believe they have effigies of you now that you can buy at the store out there, don't they?
Yes, they are available at some of the gaming stores, yes.
They call them the Jeffigies.
Yeah, there you go. Jeffigies. Jeez. Unfortunately, as much as I wanted to give a positive review, I just can't. I just can't.
Well, you got to do what you got to do, man.
Todd runs a lot of different websites. There's always new short stories. I see recently there was a new character race that was created. There is support for the game out there. If someone were to go to those websites, they're probably going to be able to pull more info to be able to run the game better.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I have to review the core book based on what the core book is, not what you can find online to help pump up the game.
Exactly.
Sorry, but thumbs down on Adventures Under the Laughing Moon.
Thumbs down and a controversy.
It's not going to be controversial.
I see the papers now.
Yes.
Brain damage.
I knew that was coming. Jeff must be brain damaged if he doesn't like Adventures Under the Laughing Moon, you fool!
But what about the Laughing Moon girls, Jeff?
What about them?
I don't know. Don't they exist?
I mean, there's some photography of the Laughing Moon girls. We discussed this a bit during the interview I did with Todd, that they kind of changed the direction of the photography. Earlier on, it was a little sexier, a little more cleavage, things like that. And they kind of changed direction to make it more story-ish, where the photography actually accents or augments the short stories that he puts out there.
Oh, okay. Well,
sorry, buddy.
No, I'm sure that's
bummed you out.
Well, that's fine. My second review is on the Walking Dead board game from Cryptozoic Entertainment. It was designed by Corey Jones and came out in 2011. It's for 1 to 4 players ages 13 and up and takes about a half hour to play. The Walking Dead is a franchise that's been on fire for some time now. With all of the zombie apocalypse exposure we've had in the past few years, it isn't surprising that two separate board games have emerged featuring Rick and the gang. One game based on the TV show and one based on the comic. Unfortunately, the word on the street has been that both of these games are terrible. If I were on a jury, I would be dismissed because of the completely human trait of not being impartial. Luckily, this isn't a court of law. It's a game review, and I can put aside the negative hype and judge the game on its own merit.
Yes, sir. We need to ask, have you had experience with zombies at all in the past? yeah, I'm a big fan. You're dismissed.
Plus, I have the advantage of discussing the game with my kids, who simply judge each game on whether or not they had fun playing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the Walking Dead TV show-based board game from Cryptozoic Entertainment. I doubt that I'll ever see the Z-Man comic book version, so I won't be comparing and contrasting the two.
What are you implying?
I don't know. Somehow I don't see a lot of Z-Man games, you know?
No, nor do we really talk about that company much. Anyway, moving right along.
The object of the game is to visit each location at the corners of the board and collect their respective location tokens, and then make it back to camp at the center of the board. If you become a zombie, your goal becomes to stop the survivors from accomplishing this task. The first thing you should know about is that the board is made of mouse pad material.
Aha!
Mm-hmm. Which was surprising to me. It was the largest mouse pad board I've ever seen. It's about 17 by 13, and you roll it up and put it in the box. It looks great, and I applaud Cryptozoic for going out on a limb and doing something different. But I can't see where this would turn off some gamers.
Why would it turn off some gamers?
Some gamers just like to have their
cardboard board.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm just kind of curious why they went in that direction.
I don't know. You know, I was interested in the same thing. You know, we're going to have to talk to them.
Oh, yeah, we will.
So why the mouse pad? I know if I ever get a huge mouse, got a mouse pad, I can put it on.
Or a rat.
Right. We don't use mice anymore. We use rats. There are 6 thick character boards, around 3 inches by 5 inches, with color pictures of the characters and a brief bio, plus the special ability that they can use once per game. You can choose from Rick, Shane, Glenn, Dale, Andrea, and Lori. The abilities can be useful or not. Shane can steal scrounge cards from every player in his region on the board, which can be very useful, while Lori can move any survivor 1 additional space, which is which is nowhere near as useful as Shane's ability.
What is it, like her nagging people to hurry up?
Right. Come on, come on. The cards are all standard size and thickness, and everything in the game features artwork and scenes taken directly from the TV show. If the kids aren't old enough to handle seeing a decaying zombie with dripping entrails, then don't let them around this game.
They shouldn't be too familiar with The Walking Dead then either.
Exactly. If you don't let them watch the TV show, I wouldn't let them play the game.
Right.
There are different smaller cards that you place at the corners of the board. You need to collect these during the game by visiting these 4 locations. Each one also gives you some special ability that you can use the rest of the game, and they really help. The character tokens are stand-ups that slide into bases and have pictures of the characters on them. Finally, there's some tokens for allies that you can pick up, a single red die, and team survivor and team zombie tokens that you'll use once some of the players have switched to the other side.
So I gotta ask you, man, like, dude, are you like team survivor or team zombie?
Team zombie all the way. This will happen. More often than not, you will end the game as a walker yourself. I like the box insert. I have to speak about box inserts.
Of course.
It has molded plastic spots to place all of the components and is covered with a black, fuzzy, felt-like material. The big problem here is that there's no finger spots to pull out the cards, so I found myself having to use a butter knife to get all the cards out of their spots in the box. This is annoying, and I hope they use more foresight in the future. We just placed some of the wedge-shaped plastic stands in the little card slots to have the deck sit in the box at a bit of an angle to help make it easier to get them out of the box. The rules are short and written fairly well, but we did have some situations pop up that were not covered in the rules, despite the page of FAQs at the back of the rulebook. We just made judgment calls and kept on trucking. It's not Arkham Horror, so the rules are simple enough not to cause a lot of hang-ups. Gameplay itself is fairly straightforward. This is a roll and move game at its core. A turn involves rolling the dice, moving, fighting zombies, and passing the dice to the next player. All players start at the center of the board in camp. Walkers can't go into camp, so it's the only safe spot on the board. Each player selects a character and gets 5 scrounge cards from the scrounge deck. The scrounge cards are the weapons and items that you will find to help you fight against the zombies. The number of cards in the deck varies with the number of players, and once a scrounge card is used and discarded, for the most part, it's out of the game. So when the deck runs out, yeah, you're on your own. Similarly, each player starts with 2 ally tokens, and then 2 more per player are placed next to the board that you can get during the game, and these ally tokens act as hit points. If you're bitten, you can surrender an ally token to survive the bite. If you're out of ally tokens and get bitten, you're dead. And you become a walker.
So the ally tokens kind of represent sort of like the character who was the wife beater?
Right. Well, actually, they have the, what was the one guy with a kid at the beginning?
Oh, gosh. Yes, because he's actually a character. He comes back in the comic.
Right. He's like on one of the ally tokens. I don't remember his name.
Gosh, yeah.
But he tries to contact him on the radio at the end of
Yes, right. Well, in the first season, yeah.
Yeah. The walker players have their own deck of cards that can really screw over the other players who are still alive. The encounter deck lasts forever. The walkers just keep coming. On your turn, you will roll the die and move that many spaces in any direction. The space you land on will almost always involve having an encounter. Some spaces specify that you will have no encounter, and some spaces give you a bonus to your attack roll, and these are nice spots to land on. Most encounters involve meeting one or more walkers. The cards have a strength value on them, and you need to meet or beat this number in order to avoid a bite. You can play cards from your hand to assist you, and then you roll a die, add your bonuses, and hope that you win. As an example, Rick lands on a blank space on the board and draws an encounter card. It's a walker pack with a strength of 8. Rick has a handgun, which gives him a +3 to his roll. He rolls a 4 for a total of 7. This isn't enough, so Rick surrenders an ally token and the encounter's over. Any roll of 6 is an automatic win for the player, so it's never impossible to win. Mostly, you'll get annoyed that you used all your gear and then rolled a 6, so your gear is all wasted, as you would have won no matter what. But, oh well, what can you do? When you reach a corner spot, you have to stop there regardless of the roll of the die when you move. Each corner involves having 2 encounters. If you survive these, you get to keep one of the tokens for that location. These give you some very helpful abilities. The police station lets you add +1 to all future attack rolls, and you will need it. The toughest cards to beat are the Walker Horde cards with a strength of 10. Some encounters might allow you to draw extra scrounge cards, or tell you that nothing happens, or some other problem that does not involve fighting walkers. This does add a bit of variety and gives you something to hope for, rather than just fighting every time.
Sure.
Once you're bitten, your token is placed on its side. Next turn, you will choose a walker token and place it wherever you were killed. For the rest of the game, you will draw cards from the walker deck and use these to try and stop the other players by turning them into zombies too. And that's really all there is to it. The game is simple, but it is hard. If someone can pull off a win as a survivor, rest assured that they had a big combination of luck and good card playing. We had one game finished with a survivor win out of 6 games that we played.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't mind this. I earned that win.
Right.
It was by the skin of my teeth. The kids liked being walkers and trying to stop me. Usually they won as the zombies, which gave them great satisfaction.
Did the kids tend to get killed before you would?
Oh, yeah. Almost always. I was the last one alive.
Maybe they wanted to be zombies right. And I munch on dad. I think you might be taking your family to some shrink, man. Some issues there.
Let me point out again that when I say kids, they're all 18 to 20. So, you know, right. Not really kids, but they're my kids.
Right. We're not talking Village of the Damned here. Yes.
Luck plays a big role in the game. You need to draw the right cards, and if you're constantly rolling a 1 or a 2 on the die when you're moving, you'll have a lot more encounters, and this will quickly lead to your death. If you hate games with a lot of luck involved, then you'll probably not enjoy The Walking Dead. The biggest problem I had with the game is that in a 4-player game, the third person to be killed is out of the game completely.
Really?
Yeah, you can only have 2 walker players, so the third person killed basically has to sit on the sidelines and watch while everyone else has a good time. This is the one design flaw that I believe should be addressed. The games are short, so it isn't a huge problem, but it really seems unfair to that third dead player.
Mm-hmm. I guess that would really throw the game out of balance.
It would,
but still,
there
yes.
Should be some kind of alternative. For this reason, the sweet spot for this game is 3 players. In a 3-player game, you won't have this problem.
No.
It would never occur. The solitaire game is fun, too. The rules don't change. You have the same goal. You just won't need to worry about running into other players that were turned into walkers. And I can't deny that I had a good time playing this game. More serious gamers should stick with games like Last Night on Earth, but casual gamers and teens really enjoy it, especially those players who are fans of the show. Management of your scrounge cards are crucial, as they can be rapidly used up. Ally tokens once used are gone forever too, so use them sparingly and only when you have no other choice. To sum it up, I liked the Walking Dead board game from Cryptozoic, and so did my kids, but it isn't for everyone, and it does have its problems.
The Miller family's bucking the trend.
Yeah, sorry. I had a good time.
So no, don't. There's no reason to apologize. If you enjoyed it, you enjoyed it. That's the whole point.
It's true. I can imagine taking a lot of flack, but you know, hey, I call them as I see them.
That's right. That's what we're here to do. Interestingly enough, I have not heard any good things about either of the Walking Dead games.
No, so neither had I, to tell
same.
You the truth.
Well, I'm very glad you enjoyed it. I'm sure Cryptozoic will be very happy that you enjoyed it too.
Probably.
As far as Z-Man's version, don't know.
Don't know.
Don't know. Won't know either. Our final review is going to be Dystopian Wars from Spartan Games, released in 2010, designed by Neil Fawcett and Elaine Padfield, with art by Robin Carey. It's for two or more players. I'd say most of your games are going to be two players, but I could easily see adapting the game for more than two. And it is a miniature system. The suggested age range is 12 and up, and you can normally play most games in about 2 hours. Imagine a world similar to our own, but subtly different. Now imagine the year is 1870, and the Industrial Revolution occurred decades earlier than in our own world. Technology is far advanced and in many cases unrecognizable, which has led to the development of fantastic naval vessels, hulking land ships, and terror from the skies in the form of airships and war balloons. The Dystopian Wars game is set in a Victorian steampunk world, and Spartan designed the rules to ensure a fun game with a large selection of high-quality models and to play in a couple of hours. The rules support naval, aerial, and land models from the outset, so you can set up battles and scenarios in any combat setting. In Europe, the Prussian Empire and the Kingdom of Britannia are mired in a bloody war of attrition for control of the mainland, whilst expeditionary forces clash among their colonies. Throughout the Pacific, the Federated States of America and the Empire of the Blazing Sun continue their struggle for dominance, raiding the colonies of the European powers. It's a time of unrest, distrust, and fear. Technology has leapt far beyond anyone's wildest imaginings. Issues of morality abandoned in the pursuit of power. Tesla's electricity has made life easier, providing light and warmth, but now also powers military vehicles and weapons. Darwin's biological experiments have yielded livestock that can feed all the hungry, as well as monsters that are all too readily unleashed upon the battlefield. And at the heart of this technological innovation stands Sturgeon's Element 270, used to create metals as light as fabric or as hard as diamonds. With changing times come changing tactics. Man cannot compete with the iron behemoths that now tread across the battlefield, at least not alone. With improved communications, there's been a revolution in the armed forces of the world. Combined arms are now the most widely accepted tactics in use, despite some die-hard commanders still stubbornly clinging to their old ways. So that's kind of the background for Dystopian Wars from Spartan Games.
It's got that steampunk theme. I like that.
It does. And it's got loads and loads of background. There are pages and pages of information on the Spartan Games website. That's how did the current situation come up, all this other stuff. The core rulebook itself is, I believe it's 124 pages long. About 14 of those are all about the background, all about the different combatants. And then there's a bunch of other information that's sprinkled all throughout the book. That's why I had mentioned in the previous review, Dystopian Wars has all of this background. I mean, it's just blowing up with theme and setting, and it's a miniatures game.
Uh-huh.
I did talk a little bit about Dystopian Wars on our last show, and I really focused on the miniatures and just how phenomenal they are. But let's talk about the rulebook, because that's the heart of the game. It's top quality. The rulebook is loaded with info, and it's got some great photographs and quite a bit of artwork. The rules are spelled out very nicely. There's loads of diagrams and examples of play. You also get a player aid card, or sheet, I guess we would say, and it's got a lot of information that's right there in front of you at a glance. The main basis of the mechanics in Dystopian Wars is an exploding die six. Kind of funny, we're talking about two games tonight that have the exploding die mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what it is, and I did kind of explain it a little bit in the previous review, it's really easy. Since it's a D6, everything's based on D6. Every time you roll a six, that counts as a hit, and you get to roll that die again. If you roll another six, you get to roll the die again, and so on. All the ships, all the land vehicles, all the different aerial vehicles as well have what's known as a damage rating. If you exceed the number of hits to this damage rating, you'll do 1 point of damage to the target. They also have a critical rating for every vehicle. And if you exceed that with your number of hits, you get to roll on the critical damage table. So how do you hit something? Easy enough, you're going to roll a number of dice equal to whatever vehicle's weapons or vessel's weapons that you're utilizing. always pretty easy to figure it out. Four, fives, and sixes hit. Each four or five is one hit. Each six counts as two. And remember, you get the exploding die, you get to roll it again. Hmm. Interesting aspect of this is no matter how big or small, any vessel, any landship, any airship is dangerous. You can actually get little frigates in the midst of dreadnoughts. And if you're rolling enough sixes, you could do some serious damage. And that's important to remember when playing the game, because just sitting there thinking, oh, big deal, it's a bunch of escorts, they can't do anything. Guess again. Because if they get in the midst of your fleet, you have broadsides and turrets. You could be firing in all directions at all different targets. It's pretty wild. The turn sequence is really simple, too. You'll roll for initiative, decide which player is going to go first. If you happen to have terrain and things like that, you can use this to go back and forth by placing pieces of terrain. Also, you can use it to say who's going to place their first squadron, because all models work in squadrons. Dreadnoughts, battleships, those are their own separate squadron. So are some of the huge landships as well. Most of the smaller vessels and vehicles all have three or five or so forth that are considered to make up a squadron. These squadrons will move, shoot, perform boarding actions, and repair all at once. You'll complete all of your actions with a squadron in the turn, and then the next player gets to activate one of their squadrons. And this will continue until all the squadrons have activated and gone through the turn. If you end up having more squadrons than your opponent, you'll end up moving more and, of course, fighting more than they would.
Right.
It's a pretty nice mechanic. You don't have to sit around and wait for nothing to happen for 15, 20 minutes while your opponent's taking their entire turn and you're watching everything get blown up. It also means that if you make a mistake, you'll have an opportunity to get yourself out of that sticky situation, too, before things get too bad. Mm-hmm. So during your activation, your squadron is going to move the models. Movement's pretty easy as well. Ships have turning templates, and flyers and land vehicles have a set distance they have to move between each 45-degree turn. And you get turning keys as well. It can be a little tricky as far as larger squadrons, and squadrons have to be within a certain distance of each other, otherwise they're considered to be out of command. And if you have a squadron that has units out of command, you have the option with that squadron, when you activate it, you can either move the units that are in command or the unit that's out of command, but not both. After that, you'll get into combat, and it could be gunnery attacks or torpedoes or rockets, the whole shebang. As I mentioned before, even the smallest ships in the game can devastate a much larger opponent in the right situation. You can shoot to your port, starboard, fore, and aft. And the actual cards for each of the vehicles and ships and so forth have everything explained directly on it, exactly what weapons they have and so forth. Range is really easy to determine as well, because there's four range bands. Each one is 8 inches long, and your model card will show what is the number of attack dice you'll roll in the first band and the second band and the third band, and if it can reach the fourth band. Something else that works very nicely is boarding actions. Each of the vessels has crews that they can use to go and attack other ships if they're in range. They're effectively using rocket packs to launch themselves to take control of the other vehicle or ship.
Really? Wow.
Yes. Thing is, your defender also has what is known as AK-AK. And that's what it's called, AK-AK. It's not called anti-aircraft or anything like that. It's not AA. It's AK-AK. You can launch a boarding attack, but the defender gets to attack you, kind of a counterattack or defensive attack as well.
Right.
So you could get wiped out before any of your Marines get control of the vessel or that vehicle. When you do damage to your enemy, you're going to reduce their hull points, and that can reduce the effectiveness of a lot of their weapons. So being the first person to pull the trigger is usually a good thing. The dreadnoughts can absorb a lot of damage before being destroyed, but you are going to see damage reduction, so their effectiveness has been reduced. Also, something that's pretty cool too is with the models, some of the turrets can be replaced with other items like rocket launchers or defensive generators. The cool thing is that all of these different units have model-specific rules for them, which could throw some people off because they have to learn, okay, what's this specific thing do? And okay, what's this one do? But to me, that adds a lot of flavor to the game. And because you can swap out these various different turret weapons, it also allows you to customize your fleet to an extent as well. You also have fighters and flyers. And the fighters, or bombers, recon, they're called tiny tokens. They have a fuel allowance, and that means that's how long they can stay in the air. But the only time they use a point of fuel is if they move at full speed or attack. If you just move them part of their distance, that their max distance, you don't attack with them, they can fly around all day if you want.
Huh, that's interesting.
But then again, what's the point of having them if you're not going to use them?
Right.
If they ever run out of fuel and they haven't landed on the specific ship they're part of, they're lost. Usually you have a squadron, it's made up of five of the tiny tokens.
Mm-hmm.
Bombers get to roll three attack dice. So a squadron attacking a ship or land vessel, whatever, they're going to roll 15 dice.
Jeez.
Yes. And just think, all those sixes you could be rolling, you'll be rolling again.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to point out the tiny token rules. They're a little heavier than the rest of the game. These rules are really, really easy to learn. I think the most difficult thing is taking a look at the different stat cards for the vehicles and the vessels and so forth, and seeing all the different little special abilities that they have, the special weapons and so forth. When you buy the starter packs, you get a full fighting force. And I'm going to mention something about that in just a minute. Another thing that's kind of cool too are what they call break checks. If your squadron loses models, they have to take a break check. It's kind of like a morale check.
Right.
And if they fail, that squadron can't do anything while they're trying to get back into the fight. They don't slow the game down at all. They're really simple to figure out. And it's kind of cool because it makes you think about maybe you should have bigger squadrons. You also have break tokens that are included in the rules. You also have a fleet commodore who is basically your fleet commander. They give some specific bonuses to other ships that are in range and help with the break checks. But if you lose that ship, guess what? Your entire fleet has to take a break check.
Oh, yeah. Whoops.
So a lot of cool little rules involved. There's also something that's available, and it's an option. It's a deck of 52 cards. You don't have to have these cards. I did pick up a deck. It introduces a real fog of war element into the game. And you get one card for each of your squadrons up to a maximum of five. They can provide bonus abilities. They can help your fleets, your vehicles, add bonuses to your attack rolls. There's four different types that are available. And it really does add some additional back and forth to the game itself.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is included in the rulebook. You don't need any other supplements, expansions, anything like that. This is the new 1.1 version of the rules, too, to point out. There's a little more info. I believe it's a little bit longer, a higher page count, I believe, in this edition as well.
Yeah.
And everything you need to play the game outside the miniatures is included in this book. Everything's not completely perfect with Dystopian Wars, though. To be very honest, my gripe is very, very minor. But in my opinion, I think there should have been a painting guide included in the book itself. There are quite a few photos of the different units, not a ton of them. So I was kind of surprised there wasn't as much photography in the book as I'm used to with a lot of the full color rule books that are out there for other systems.
Yeah.
There is enough, but there's no specific painting guide, which can be good and it can be bad too. There's enough there that you know how you should probably paint your units. Myself, just as a side note, I'm going to go against the grain, and my Federation of America ships are going to be painted like the Great White Fleet of Teddy Roosevelt, when U.S. ships were all white.
My God, man, is that legal?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I really, really dig Dystopian Wars. This game is awesome. It is excellent. And there's a lot of reasons why. The rules are easy to figure out. There's loads of flavor to them. The game plays fast. It's a real slam bang action packed game. It's not a lot of maneuvering and moving around to get into position. Now you're pretty much getting into the heart of the action pretty quickly. And the cost to buy in is pretty low. You see, a battle group, naval or land, is going to run you, I believe with the exchange rate right now, it's about, I think, $48. And if you pick up the core rule book, I believe it's about $30, you're good to go. That's it. That's all you need to spend. Now, if you look at some of the other systems that are out there that are really popular, and I'm not trying to pick on Games Workshop, but let's look at Warhammer 40K. You got to get the rule book, which is about $60. You have to get your army codex. So that's another book you have to pick up specifically for whatever army you're going to play with. That's about $35. Mm-hmm. Then you got the miniatures. I don't think we need to go into a whole lot of rehashing over the cost of GW figures. So you're probably looking at a total investment just to get playing with Warhammer 40K of probably around $250, maybe $300 if you want to follow the organization charts that come with the game. So the buy-in cost for Dystopian Wars is really low. And as I had mentioned in the previous show, these models are awesome. They are excellent. I still haven't had a chance to start painting them. I have primed them all and cleaned them, so they are good to go. Hopefully in the next month or so, I'll be able to start sharing photographs of painting them up. All in all, a huge big thumbs up for Dystopian Wars from Spartan Games. I also want to point out coming in June is going to be the first supplement to Dystopian Wars, and it's going to have some new rules. It's going to have a bunch of scenarios. It's not something you need to buy to play the game. It's called Hurricane Season, and that will be out in June.
So what are the odds we'll get a chance to maybe play in a Dystopian Wars event, maybe at Origins or something?
Got to take a look to see what they've got cooking.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Do they even do have miniatures events there, right?
Oh, yeah. Remember we went through the, I guess we wouldn't say events. I guess we would say just regular
games,
scheduled games, right? There were quite a few miniatures games that we saw. Remember we were walking around, there were people who had foot-high mechs. It looked like there was quite a bit of Flames of War being played.
Right, okay.
I'm going to have to take a look. I'm not sure if Spartan Games will be at Origins. I'm almost positive, 99.9% positive, they will be at Gen Con.
Gen Con, yeah.
So I'll be more than happy to contact Gary Bent. He's one of the people who are in charge of Spartan Games. We've emailed back and forth quite a bit. I'll see what they've got going on, either at Origins or Gen Con, so we can see if we can get into one of their games.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, kind of like a starter game.
Yeah.
This is over a 9. It's 9.3, 9.4-ish. So yes, this is awesome. Like I said, the only drawback that I can say about the game is the tiny tokens, the flyer rules, a little tricky, and there could have been more painting information in the core book. And that is it. I guarantee you will enjoy it.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And just to check out the models too, the models are just super sweet.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to
painting them up. Wait till I get some of them painted up. Yeah, exactly. And get them up there. I think you'll be pretty impressed. Uh-huh. And I'll put some stuff. Usually you'll see somebody put like a quarter or a penny or something like that to kind of give you an idea of scale. That's something else that I want to throw out just real quick. This scales really well. Everything feels right about it. You know how sometimes you'd be playing a game and it just seems strange that, oh, wow, you know, this can actually fire this far, or, geez, this weapon kind of stinks. It only fires 3 inches? What the heck is the point of that?
Right.
Everything plays out about right. Those range bands make the game super easy. 8 inches, 8 inches, 8 inches, 8 inches. Pow. Done.
Cool.
So there you go.
I'm hyped about it. So.
Yeah, I know. One of the best miniatures games I've played in a long time.
Cool.
And that's not to knock any other miniatures games out there. It's different. It's fun. You love games that have theme and flavor.
I do.
That's why you'll dig this.
Okay, cool.
There you have it for the reviews. One last thing I did want to mention before we go. One of our listeners emailed us last week Sean Stasko, and he was curious about the Walt Disney book that Elliot and I were talking about on a previous show. Not the last show, it was the show before that, if I remember correctly.
Uh-huh.
And neither one of us knew, we couldn't remember the name of it off the top of our heads. He had contacted us and asked, hey, you know, what's the name of that book? I think my wife would really enjoy it. So right away, Elliot and I both emailed him back the information because, of course, then we remembered it.
Right.
I just wanted to say, if anybody ever has a question about something we talk about or something we make a reference to, don't hesitate to ask us. A lot of times we're talking off the cuff, especially when we kind of go off on our mini
tangent
detours. Well, I don't want to say tangent. If we can answer any questions, anything like that, do not hesitate to send us an email or comment and ask on the website itself. We're always more than happy to tell you if we know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Elliot, before we finish up?
Nope. I think I'm good.
All right. Well, everybody, thanks for listening once again, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Elliot, take us out.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.